During our week together, I want to speak on one of, if not the most important issue in the minister's life, and that is the family. Especially, but not exclusively, the things related to the rearing of our children. In fact, throughout the semester, as I returned to this pulpit, through the months of the semester, speaking a time or two each month, I want to stay on the same theme of the home and the family. In case that seems a little bit irrelevant or not nearly as stimulating as some theological subject that would be of interest, especially to you who are single, let me remind you of a verse or two in Scripture that I think will heighten your appreciation for the subject, especially if you plan in the future to candidate and to serve in some part of the church of our Lord Jesus Christ. And the verses in mind are from 1 Timothy chapter 3, verses 4 and 5, which are a part of the listing of the requirements of the minister of the gospel. There are 15 listed in all, and when he gets to the last three, the apostle not only names the requirement, but also adds a warning. And this particular requirement, he spends the most time on. 1 Timothy 3, verse 4, he must be one who manages his own household well, keeping his children under control with all dignity. Then that parenthesis, it's a haunting statement that will come back to you again and again as you grow your children, as you train them, especially in their adolescent years. Verse 5. If a man does not know how to manage his own household, how will he take care of the church of God? First, the requirement, verse 4, he must be one who manages his own household well. And then the warning, if he does not manage his household, how can he manage the church of God? Not only is there insight in these verses for us to find, but I like it that the church is portrayed in family life, not business. The people of the church are not employees. They're brothers and sisters. That's family talk. The pastor is not portrayed as the boss, but rather as a shepherd, as in many people's eyes, as a father. I remember when I resigned from the church in Fullerton, California, after almost 23 years, how many notes I got, especially from the younger men and women in the congregation who said they feel like they're losing their dad. Though I had never attempted that role in their lives, the role of a pastor is often seen as a role of a father, and especially so to the fatherless. And those who long to have a role model, a masculine role model. Eugene Peterson paraphrases this: he must handle his own affairs well, attentive to his own children, and having their respect. You know, and I have learned over the years that respect is not something we command or demand of people. It's something we earn. And in the home, the most exacting of all laboratories, we earn the respect of our mates and our children each day. Not only as success marks our lives, but especially as we fail, as we fall short, Children can be the most forgiving people on earth if in the midst of failure we admit it and we seek their forgiveness and treat them with dignity. Respect comes our way. Since entering the ministry over 30 years ago, I have witnessed the disturbing trends of our times, and at the risk of marking me as an older man today, I'm going to name three of the trends that concern me, all of them having to do with the home. First is the break up and breakdown of families. I was interested to discover that in 1970, single-parent families comprised 12.9% of all the families in America. 1970. By 1994, 30.8% of all the families with children were led by a single parent. I remember getting a call from the superintendent of schools in our little community in Southern California a number of years ago. He said, "Well, Chuck, we passed the mark." He was superintendent of a particular grammar school, of a group of grammar schools. He said, "For the first time in our history, more of our students live in single-parent homes than live with their original two-parent. Rarely did I perform marriages in the last 20 years of my pastorate where both bride and groom were from a solid and still together home. Rarely. Usually one of them would be, often neither of them. Rarely did both come from homes where mom and dad who bore them were still together and sitting together for that wedding." The breakup and breakdown of families is a trend that will disturb you as you enter ministry this year or in some year that follows. Second, the pace and the race of parents. I watched as families became busier, walked and talked and thought and acted out faster. One particular resource reads, "The demands of a job that claim mealtimes, evenings, and weekends, as well as days, the trips and moves necessary to get ahead or simply to hold one's own, the increasing time spent commuting, entertaining, going out, meeting social and community obligations, all of these produce a situation in which a child often spends more time with a passive babysitter than with a participating parent. A team of researchers wanted to learn how much time middle-class fathers spend playing and interacting with their small children. First, they asked a group of fathers to estimate the time they spent with their one-year-old youngsters each day. They received an average reply of 15 to 20 minutes. To verify these claims, the investigators attached microphones to the shirts of small children for the purpose of recording actual parental verbalization. The result of the study was shocking. The average amount of time spent by these middle-class fathers with their small children was 37 seconds a day. Their direct interaction was limited to 2.7 encounters daily, lasting 10 to 15 seconds each. I watched, and I still watch, with a bit of a heartbreak at how quickly people move through life, especially in the child-bearing and child-rearing years, which is where most of you find yourselves. The third thing that I have watched and watched with a great deal of concern has been the abuse and the neglect of children. Child abuse is now out of the closet. It was not spoken of in the 1950s or 60s. Only the most extreme cases would ever make the newspaper report. Now there are child protective agencies. Now there are organizations that answer a 911 call and immediately are at the home or at the school to take care of the child that is reportedly being abused. Abuse can be overt and physical. It can be verbal. This is very common in Christian families. It can be emotional abuse. It can be violent and vicious. It can be sexual and life-threatening. We had to help our nursery workers know how to handle cases that they felt or represented abuse of infants, of small children. And neglect is usually unconscious. It is often springing from an attitude. It, by the way, doesn't leave after the children are gone. Columnist Ann Landers, in a surprising response to a question she had asked her readers, the question, "If you had known then what you now know, would you have had children?" She was surprised. Among the 10,000 women who answered, an amazing 70% said no. 70%. One unidentified woman added, "Would I have children again? 1,000 times no. My children have completely destroyed my life, my marriage, and my identity as a person. There are no joys. Prayers did not help. Nothing stops a screaming kid." Boy, she must have been a fun mother, huh? Now, let's get at the core of the problem. We understand the difficulty of our times. Let's see, and at the risk of sounding terribly simplistic, I believe the answer is really a part of the issue of training our children. And with that in mind, I invite you to turn to the familiar Proverb 22, verse 6. How we manage our homes will be in direct relation to how we train our children. The great question is, how and when do we begin training the young? It's going to sound unusual to say this, but I'm going to say it. I think our training and the success we have in it is directly linked to how well we know our child. And I don't mean by knowing a child, knowing its weight or knowing the color of its hair or eyes. Anybody knows that. A child born to us longs to be known. I have some theories about rebellion. I think that it's often and usually related to a child's frustration in not knowing herself or himself. All part of this whole thing of neglect. Frankly, I'm of the opinion that most children are reared by parents who do not know them. They provide for them. They are cared for. It's often in affluent homes where there were plenty of clothes and money and things and food, but they are not known by their parents. 22:6. Train up a child in the way he should go, even when he is old, he will not depart from it. Now, the standard interpretation goes something like this in the Christian home. Be sure your child is in Sunday school and church regularly. Teach the child the Ten Commandments, a few prayers, and Bible verses. and some of the hymns and choruses of the faith. Send him or her to a Christian school so his education is based on biblical foundations. If possible, add a summer camp each year to help cement all of this in his mind or her mind. Because after all, someday, usually in the teenage years, this person will sow wild oats. He'll rebel and have his fling. But when he's old enough to get over that fling, God promises that he will come back to God. Well, for a long time I believed that, and it always made me frown because it was never very comforting to interpret the verse like that. When this child is old, decrepit, and finished with his fling, he'll crawl back to God. He's too old to do anything else, and so he comes back to God. Frankly, it isn't true. That isn't what the verse is teaching. I'm now convinced of this. Experientially, it isn't true. You and I can name people who never came back to God. They rebelled, they're still rebelling, and in some cases they have died in a rebellious state, though they were raised by parents who squeezed them into the standard Christian mold of their culture. Some of you are rebels at heart. You can't figure out why. Some of us can't either. And you find yourself out of control, unable to bring the controls, the boundaries into your own life, all related to the way you were not trained by parents who perhaps meant well. I don't think parents wake up in the morning, sit on the side of the bed and think, how can I ruin my child today? Let's see. What things can I do to get them off course? That's stupid. That's not what I'm referring to. I think most of it is a matter of just ignorance. Experientially, it isn't true, and furthermore, exegetically, it isn't true. I don't think that's what the verse is teaching. I don't think the verse is out of date. I think the verse suffers from abuse, pastoral abuse. Originally, these words were written in Hebrew. Let's see if we can do some work in the original text that will help us understand or at least get some light on the subject. And allow me for the next few moments sort of pedantically to take the verse apart. Look at the verse. Follow carefully. Train up. If my research is correct, the absolute origin of the term came to mean the palate or the roof and gums of the mouth. In verb form, it took on the meaning of bringing about experience and submission in the midst of the experience. It is used, for example, for putting a rope in a horse's mouth to bring it under control and to break it and to guide it. It's used for the action of a midwife who, after aiding in the birth of the child, would dip her finger in a small pool of crushed dates or grapes and would massage the palate and the gums of the newborn, thinking that it had antiseptic value as well as creating a sucking sensation in the child, creating a taste, perhaps would be a part of a paraphrase. We'll come back in a moment. The verse refers to a child. Train up a child. Now, your thought and mine is a little child, a tiny infant, a preschooler. But I found in tracing the original word child that through the Old Testament, it's used of children and young men and women of all ages living under the roof of the parents. Bear with me. 1 Samuel 4 refers to a newborn infant. Exodus 2, Moses is 3 months old, called, same word, translated child. 1 Samuel 1, Samuel is being weaned and called a child, older than 3 months. certainly. Genesis 21, Ishmael is called in the text a lad, but he is in this case a preteen. In Genesis 37, Joseph is called, same term, a youth, 17 years old. 17 years old, and still the same word. Genesis 34, there is a man who is presented here, a man of marriageable age called, same original word. What am I getting at? It is a child, a teenager, a young adult of any age, still living under the parents' roof, still at home. Now it's making sense. This is a promise worth claiming. The point is, it applies to a child of any age as long as the child is still living at home. In the way he should go, pregnant with meaning. The first glance seems to be saying, parents, you know the way. Push him into it. Get the child into the way you know he ought to go. If you carry a New American Standard, you'll notice the marginal reference marked literally is, train up a child according to his way. That's altogether different than your way. Especially when you analyze the term way. Derek is the word. It means road or path. Figuratively, it means characteristics. Let me show you. Proverbs chapter 30, verse 18. There are three things which are too wonderful for me, four which I do not understand. He names them. The derrick of an eagle in the sky, the derrick of a serpent on a rock, the derrick of a ship in the midst of the sea, the derrick of a man with the maid. It doesn't refer to a path. There is no path in the sky. Not literally. It's the characteristic of a soaring eagle, flies like no other fowl. And when you see them, students of nature know immediately that's an eagle. Or the slithering movement of a snake on the rock. No other creature has such a characteristic as the serpent. The way of a ship at sea. The love-making intimacy of a man with a maid. The romance. No two are alike. The point is, there are characteristics which I call mannerisms. In fact, the same term is used in Psalm 7, verse 12, and 11, verse 2, for the bending of a bow. Probably means the idea of putting down the foot so as to take the other end of the bow and string it before the warrior goes to battle or the hunter goes into the field. Putting the foot down came to mean making a path or making a road. The bending of the bow ties in with the figurative language of this text, I suggest. The whole idea of the bents of a child. I have before me a Ryrie study Bible and the note Charles Ryrie adds to this is right on target. That is, the child's habits and interests. The instruction must take into account his individuality and inclinations. Listen to me. The child does not come to us from the mother's womb as a soft, pliable piece of clay, but as an individual with characteristics and bents already built in. That's what makes us all so different. Woven into the fabric of that life is a personality unlike any other personality. Certain interests and gifts, leanings, and abilities. We'll say more about that in a moment. Back to the verse. Create an atmosphere. Develop a thirst in a child of any age, in keeping with that child's God-given bents, mannerisms, characteristics. The Bible is full of examples of differences within the same family. Adam had, and Eve had Cain and Abel, altogether different, same home. Isaac and Rebekah had twins, opposites, twins. Esau the older, Jacob the younger. One was an outdoorsman, loved to hunt and kill his food. Jacob was a little sissy, sort of like hanging around the kitchen. And he learned from one of his parents' deception and manipulation and talked his own brother out of his birthright. Solomon and Absalom, David and Eliab, the list goes on. Same family, same context, most often same parents, but different. Because they were different. Some children are strong and determined, others are weak and easily influenced. One of your children will be creative and dreamy and a lover of the arts, the other one draws a weird-looking horse. Can hardly draw a straight line. One is stubborn and aggressive and strong-willed, and another is cooperative and willing. Not many are cooperative and willing, but some are. One has a sense of humor that keeps the family laughing. The other is very serious. I see it in our 8 grandchildren, our oldest grandchild. Very serious, very bright, loves the computer. Another of the siblings doesn't know how to turn it on and doesn't care a bit about it. One of them is very athletic. She happens to be the youngest in the family. Her older brother is larger and stronger, but he loves art. And the best thing we can do when babysitting him is provide him with paper and pen and colors, and he draws well. I play ball with his sister out in the backyard. And She's great, but they're two in the same family from the same womb, raised in the very same context. How important it is that the parent rear the child according to those characteristics and bents. How you would long to have been reared like that. This leads us to a couple of very common, popular errors parents make. First, we use the identical approach with all of our children, usually based on the way we were raised. My dad did this, and I'm going to do it too, which proves only sustained ignorance in many cases. What if your dad was wrong in the way he did it? What if he wasn't sensitive to who you are? You desire to, no, you don't want to carry that on. Cynthia and I both come from very interesting backgrounds, and we decided, while seminary student, we decided we would make a break with our past and how we were raised. My situation was altogether different from hers. She can hardly remember a day when her father was not angry. And from teenage years on, her mother worked alongside her angry father, her angry husband. And it took its toll on the home and the family. And we decided when we had our children, we wouldn't be raising our children as we were raised. And however good or weak our background was, we decided we wouldn't perpetuate it. We would study our children and not use the same approach. Second common problem is comparing children in the family. Don't lift your hands, but how many of you lived with that in your home? I mean, my brother brought home the most boring report card you could possibly offer parents to look at. Same letter all the time. I had variety. I had a different approach to it. And so we bring both report cards up before all the kids and we parade them so that everybody knows what everybody made. We decide in the rearing of our children, we would never share what they made in report cards. And to this day, they do not know what the other one made. Why? Why should they know? What good does that do but bring guilt to the one who has the variety and bring pride to the one who came out so well? I was sitting on a platform getting ready to deliver a commencement speech, and they were standing and applauding the valedictorian of the graduating class. I noticed the man sitting next to me, a Dallas grad, a good friend of mine, didn't applaud. And I said, you're the only guy not clapping. He said, if you knew the attitude of that gal, you wouldn't clap either. Interesting. Great IQ, rotten attitude. Somewhere in the training, that wasn't addressed. Who grades attitudes? And yet in life, that is far more significant than intelligence. You will never be run out of a church because your intelligence is low. But a bad attitude? Get ready for the pink slip. Yeah. According to his way. When he is old, the term means hair on the chin. It has reference to manhood. When he reaches adulthood, when he begins to grow hair, there's a promise worth claiming. Cultivate an atmosphere in the taste of a child according to the way he has been bent and made and prescribed by God, and train accordingly. And when he or she reaches maturity, they will not walk away from the training. How do you do that? Part of that is the balance of this week that I want to talk about. It requires time. It requires concentration. It requires objectivity. It requires sensitivity. When I say objectivity, I remember again a common mistake of parents, especially dads, who didn't quite make the ranks of professional football. They did very well in high school, scholarship to college, but they didn't make the cut. So the great goal as soon as they get a little boy is to turn him into the dream that they never realized. Problem is, he's got a little artistic, creative kid who can't even catch a pass and has no interest in it. And he wonders, what's wrong with that kid? Amazing story I read about several years ago of a little baby that was born into the home of a family just like that. So happened the dad was a professional ball player. First gift he gave his little newborn was a football. Ball was bigger than the little kid. Dropped it in the crib. Man, they were playing catch before the kid was hardly able to walk. And throughout his life, he had special trainers and special assistants and special time and attention given to turn that boy into an athlete. Interestingly, he got into the pro ranks. He didn't make it. Flaked out. You know what he's doing? He's playing in a band today. His dad must wonder, is there a God? What kind of treatment is that? He missed it altogether. What are we doing tossing footballs in cribs? What are we doing trying to live out our frustrations through the lives of our little ones? It's not only unbiblical, what's worse for them, it's unfair. I care very much about this because I know that our time as pastors is very limited. But could that be the reason pastors' kids are notoriously rebels? Could that be the reason you've had such struggles? You have such difficulty being at rest in your spirit? We become what we live with, said one lady. If a child lives with criticism, he learns to condemn. If a child lives with hostility, he learns to fight. If a child lives with ridicule, he learns to be shy. If a child lives with shame, he learns to feel guilty. If a child lives with tolerance, he learns to be patient. child lives with encouragement, he learns to have confidence. If a child lives with praise, he learns appreciation. With fairness, he learns justice. With security, he learns to have faith. If a child lives with approval, he learns to like himself. If he lives with acceptance and friendship, he learns to find love in the world. Wouldn't it be great to make a break with your past? Wouldn't it be wonderful, in case you have been scarred by an uncaring, or, and I say this carefully, and just an ignorant parent who didn't know the harm he or she was causing? Wouldn't it be great that you, with your child, could break that syndrome? We'll talk about how to do that tomorrow. Thank you, Father, for the help you give us from the principles of Scripture, how timeless and timely they are. We're grateful for them, more importantly for you, who will guide us into all truth. And we're grateful in Jesus' dear name.